linguistic art chicks.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. And like a lot of our fellow saloners, I'm discovering that once again, getting things done in the summertime just seems to take a little longer than at other times of the year. Maybe it's just me, but I sure do slow down in the summertime. But two people who didn't slow down this week are Douglas S. and Jorge H., both of whom sent in really generous donations that most definitely help with the expenses here in the salon. So thanks a lot for the donations, Douglas and Jorge. They are very, very much appreciated. Now, if you were here with us last week, you know that I told you that today we would begin listening to a Timothy Leary workshop. Well, I've changed my mind. Not about the person we'll be hearing from today, but I'm going to play a different talk than the one I told you about, which was his superintelligence seminar that took place in May of 1985. But fear not if you had your heart set on listening to that seminar, because I'm going to post download links to that entire unedited seminar along with the program notes for today's podcast. And so if you're a major Dr. Leary scholar, you can listen to it at your leisure. But the reason I'm not playing it here is that I think it's way too slow for a podcast. Now, this may just be my own bias coming out here, but I started working on the first tape, and by the time I'd processed an hour of it, I realized that without the pressure of a time deadline, the good doctor often just rambled off in a dozen different directions and didn't always complete one thought before moving on to another. And so a large part of what I heard was mainly just good-natured give and take between him and the workshop audience. Now, the way I produce these podcasts is to first go through a talk and edit out all of the dead spots where somebody in the audience might ask a long question that can't be clearly heard, and so it'd sort of be a dead spot in the recording. Then I record my own comments and kludge it all together, lay in some background music by Chatul Hayuk, which I should point out again is compliments of my friend Jacques, who also appears as Poloka in my novel, by the way. Anyway, after spending a couple of hours editing out all of the parts that made no sense without some video to go along with it, I realized that I was intending to skip the final step of my process, which is to do a final listen-through of the finished podcast. And so I realized that if I didn't even want to listen to it again, then why should I put it out as a podcast and force you to do it? Maybe I'm being a little too critical here, but the end result is that I've found another talk by Dr. Leary that is, at least to me, much more interesting, exciting, and upbeat. And that's what we're going to hear right now. Hopefully you have enough interest in learning how we got to where we are today that the talk about personal computers in this lecture will be of some interest to you. So keep in mind that the talk we're about to hear was given in July of 1987, and at that time, not even a measurable percentage of people in this country even had a personal computer, and the web was still five or more years away. Now, I happened to be in the personal computer business myself quite early on. In fact, my company was incorporated in 1980, Dynasty Computer Corporation, headquartered in Dallas, Texas. And within 3 years, we'd made the front page of the Wall Street Journal and had a feature article in Forbes magazine. So I am very familiar with the early history of the PC business, and I'm here to tell you that the good Dr. Leary was as far ahead of those times as any person alive back then. I know that it'll be hard to believe when you hear him describing what he saw as future tech, but that is exactly what the best technical minds of the day were also predicting. But what Timothy Leary brought to the table that us geeks missed at the time was the importance that this new tech was going to have on our great work of waking up the human holon. Let me just give you one more little fact to illustrate how far ahead of the times Dr. Leary was. At the time he gave the talk we were about to hear, the total sales of IBM PCs, and that is the total of all sales from its introduction in 1981 through the summer of 1987, well, it was less than 18,000, and the big name in home computers at that time was Apple. That's right, only 18,000 PCs had been sold by then. So when you hear him trying to convince the audience that personal computers were really the coming thing, well, keep in mind the fact that outside of Northern California audiences, there probably weren't more than one or two computer owners in the entire audience at most places where he was speaking. I know that thought is kind of laughable today, and yet this talk was given just 22 years ago this month. A lot sure has happened since then, particularly on the tech front, as you well know. Anyway, enough of my reminiscences. Now let's join the audience at the Stone on a San Francisco summer night in 1987.
Hey, you, yeah. Really, there's no place in the world I'd rather be tonight, Friday night, July, than in San Francisco. The most sophisticated, cybernetic, psychedelic, amplified people around. Now, we got to have a bumper sticker or a label or a title for our little interaction tonight. We could try this one about the cybernetic society of the 21st century. Or how about the emergence of the cybernetic person during the roaring 20th century? Huh? Yeah. That's you. Actually, the hook for this season's series of involvements is, of course, the Summer of Love. It was 20 years ago this season, 20 years ago today, that the Beatles came out with that album that really swept the world and kind of told everyone that there was something new happening. So there's a lot of kind of interest in, hey, what's happened in the last 20 years? And there's been a lot of reunions, which I'll tell you a little bit about in a minute. And it's nice to kind of check up on what's happening. The question is, of course, why did the Summer of Love happen in the year 1967? Well, a good reason for that. Actually, the so-called 60s celebration and movement did start. It became visible in the year 1967. I think there's a good reason for that. It's demographic and it's arithmetic. See, the baby boom started in 1946. Now, you add 21 to 46 and you get 1967. So to me, that summer of love was kind of a coming out party, a coming of age party of the first wave, the first year of the baby boom. And of course, it happened. It started where else? It started right here in San Francisco. It was January 14th, 1967, in Golden Gate Park when they had the first human being or love in. Hey, what is that? You know, nobody ever heard that concept before. That was a new one. And it was all very informal. Somebody asked me today, who organized it? I said, organized it? I mean, there ain't no such thing. And the word went out over the rock stations and word of mouth. It was all around the Bay Area. And without anybody realizing what was happening, I don't know, what, 20, 30,000 people suddenly showed up on a January day. That was pretty interesting. And everybody kind of looked around and said, there's a lot of people, a lot of activity, a lot of action going on here. It was perhaps, I think, May, was it, when the same thing happened in New York. They had another bee in there. They had about 50,000. Hey, it started building up. This is this could become a habit. Then June 1967, that album came out. Now, most of you remember where you were when you... you lost your virginity or you gained your whatever you call it. you remember where you were when Columbus discovered America in 1492. Remember that. And short-term memory loss. But I think most of us remember where we were the first time you heard that album. You picked that album up and there were all those funny pictures. And when you start playing that, you realize this was a signal. This was a statement. This was a real basic positioning here, that this was not just another rock and roll record, it was not just love and June and moon. This was a philosophic, a poetic, a social statement that something new was happening. It was a concept album. And above all, there were ideas in it, made you think, and hey, what do they mean, and so forth. You know, how many millions of people spent, how many wasted, spaced out nights trying to decipher and decode the meanings of some of those lyrics? But So I would say the 60s really started in 67. Now, if it started in 67, let's see, what happened? Well, okay, 68, within 9 months, this new movement of young people, kind of celebrating individuality and indicating they wanted a change, and Dylan was saying, ain't going to work on Maggie's farm no more. Within 9 months, they had gotten rid of the president, LBJ. He just tucked tail and ran back to Texas, man. And the people went clean for Gene, and Bobby Kennedy came out for the kids. And then 68 was the Chicago Convention, kind of shook everything up. The Democratic Party's never been the same since then. And 69, Woodstock. Can you believe Woodstock? 400,000 people on a weekend coming up to some farm in New York State. That became the third largest city in the state of New York. 400,000 or 500,000 people, almost no sanitation, no real good food, taking God knows what kind of drugs day and night. And you know, there wasn't one recorded act of violence. Isn't that amazing? Can you imagine 400,000 horny teenagers today getting together with things are kind of... But it was a kind of a lesson. It was kind of a signal that, hey, this is something new. Then 70, 72, 73, Watergate. The 60s really, really didn't get going until the 70s. And I think the 60s peaked in the year 1976 when we elected as our president the ultimate hippy-dippy howdy-doody Jimmy Carter. he was had a sleeping bag, and he was quoting Bob Dylan, and he playing softball with Ralph Nader and talking about lust in his heart. Whoa, yeah. And, you know, in the grim Rambo Pitbull Ollie North 80s, it seems kind of pathetic. That guy was talking about love and peace, and he got Sadat and Begin to come over there, and he got him in that Camp David, and he said, come on, Anwar, give peace a chance, and all you need is love, Menachem, and, you know. And they didn't let that happen very long. Now, this so-called movement, see, what was happening was every summer a new wave of kids became 21 and started joining the party. I think the whole thing ended in this country in the year 1980 when we kind of hit that wall and elected as president. Was it Nancy Reagan? No, it was Admiral Poindexter. That's where the buck stops. Yeah, so... but, you know, this movement that started here in San Francisco 20 years ago didn't stop in America. It kept moving around. By 68, it was in France. They called it l'été d'amour. You remember those riots there? They closed the country down. And it hit in Spain as soon as the old General Franco died. Young peoples took over, and Hope and Playboy magazine was shown in public, and they legalized marijuana. You know, that idea of the summer of love, which has something to do with we ain't going to work on the assembly line Maggie's farm for the military anymore. We're going to work out a new way of life with individuality. It's still going around. Can you believe, for example, the TV we've been seeing, you know, on news in South Korea? And that's something, South Korea. You know, it's a standard 1960 scenario. Here are the college students, you know, in white shirts, throwing flowers and rocks. And there's the old Darth Vader, FBI, CIA, DEA. And this is the old classics. Where'd they learn it? Well, you know where they learned it. South Korea is a cybernetic television culture. You can't have these young kids watching television and playing rock and roll and listening to CD records from America and from England. Hey, they're not going to let those old kids. So I don't know what they call it in South Korea, but they got a name for it. And the interesting thing, you know, in South Korea, it's not political. It's not left or right, or it's not... It's generational. Also, how about this? In Japan, there's a new generation that's come up 10 years later, born starting around 55. In Japan, these people are called Shinjin Rui. And the translation of that, now you're going to think I'm quoting from a Beatles album or from the poetry of Allen Ginsberg, the new breed, or new breed of human being. Now, what's this new breed about? Well, I read about this, by the way, in Fortune magazine. Hey, get over there. These the young Japanese are not going to scrimp and save. They want to spend money. They want to enjoy life. They don't want to work on Sony's farm no more. They're hedonic. Can you imagine Fortune magazine talking about hedonic? That means they want Haagen-Dazs or whatever, but... But the real triumph of the summer of love, to me, this season at least, is of all places, Russia. You know, there's this concept of perestroika, which means loosening up, and glasnost, which means, opening up and restructuring. And I don't know really what happens there, because we don't know really. But as I can decipher what's coming, you know, through in the press and the various European press too, there is an attempt to get rid of the old guard World War II generals, and they're going to reward workers for what they do. They got Stalin and Marx spinning in their grave. There was a big kind of a convention in Russia. They brought in scientists and poets and artists from all over the world, and they had a large delegation from America. But you know who the star of the whole thing was? David Sheff told me about this. Never mind, it wasn't necessarily the liberal senators or the distinguished novelists. It was Yoko Ono. And there was a personal meeting between Gorby. I love the New York Post. That's a right-wing, you know. They call him Gorby. Well, Mrs. Gorby met with Yoko Ono and said, "Isn't it too bad that John couldn't be here? And thanks for giving peace a chance." And, now listen, me. Yoko Ono couldn't get within 10 miles of the Poindexter White House, where they have music like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and, you know, Frank Sinatra and so forth. So the point I'm making here is that this movement that started here, which was a generational, which was, I think, was an inevitable historic movement, has been going on and is still going on. And every time, every place, you see a new generation of young people coming along, stressing freedom, individuality, loosening up the censorship, down military, you know that the thing is happening. I wish we could get back in this country, but I think we will. Now, I told you I've been having a few reunions in the last few weeks. I've been around the country having kind of reunions with some of the people from the 60s. In San Francisco, I remember two months ago, there was Dr. Benjamin Spock, Tom Robbins, Ken Kesey, about 3 months ago, I had a reunion in Toronto, Canada, with Abbie Hoffman and Eldridge Cleaver. That was a hot one. Now, I'm sure most of you have seen Abbie. I mean, you know that Abbie is simply one of the greatest orators of all time. I mean, you turn the fast speed forward, boy, and you've got a rap. I mean, Abbie taught rap. He's got bandoliers of one-liners and cartridge belts of facts and figures. I mean, boy, he just... Vroom. He knows how many helicopters the Honduras government is using in Nicaragua. He knows how many gallons of urine is being tested by the drug testers. Abbie's got it. There's only one minor fault that Abbie has. No one's perfect. Abbie doesn't listen too well. But that's cool because, you know, if he does all the talking, it's less for me to do. So they'd ask me a question about drugs and Abbie would answer. That's great, you know. But then Eldridge got on the stage, and Eldridge, I go back so far with Eldridge Cleaver. We're like twins or genetic. We've been so many through lifetimes together. I knew Eldridge in 1968 when he was running for president. On the Peace and Freedom ticket. He was running against, Nixon, yeah. Now, I think Eldridge would have then and would now make a better candidate for president than most of them. You know, Eldridge can keep three ideas in mind. That's three times more than Reagan can. So these three ideas are back in the 60s, and then I was with Eldridge over in Algeria. We had a lot of fun there. The three ideas he had were... there's one enemy, and that enemy is racist, Christian, Wall Street, lacking, running dogs of capitalism. Got that? Yeah. And there's only one good cause, and that's Marxist, Leninist, and I. Got that? Yeah. And there's only one solution in this. You're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem, and that's the barrel of the gun. That's where democracy starts. Got it? Yes, sir. Well, now, Aldridge from Toronto, you know, he's changed. He's a born-again Christian. He's also a right-wing Republican. He ran for Senate here in California. Yeah. So when he's talking about this, he's saying the same things. That now the enemies, Marxists, Leninists, and so forth, and you got to line them up against the wall, mother flubber, and the cause is, of course, Christianity, and still the barrel of the gun. So you can imagine. Here's poor Abby Hoffman going crazy. He can't stand this. He wants to get the microphone back, and finally he gets the microphone back. He says, Eldridge, it's an impossibility. You cannot exist. There's no such thing as a black Republican. You're an oxymoron. Eldridge said, what are you calling me now? You're an oxymoron. You're a contradiction in terms, like military intelligence or working press. There ain't no such thing. Furthermore, Eldridge, about this born-again Christian shit. I asked my mother about that. My good Jewish mother said, no way, kid. I wouldn't do it again the first time with you. So, anyway, that was a pretty good debate. I've had wonderful times with Hunter Thompson, and boy, he's really. Now, if you want to ask a question about any of these guys later in the question period, I'll be glad to tell you more about it. The most interesting debates I've had this year have been with a man who for 5 years was the head of the DEA. Now, when they called me and said, would you like to debate this guy? Would I like to debate the head of the DEA? Would David like to debate Goliath? So, Peter Bensinger. He's a nice guy. He's a gentleman. I'm sure he's an excellent administrator. And he's a Yale man, but I won't hold that against him. He's actually very intelligent and a nice guy. Only one flaw in his thing is that he doesn't know a damn thing about drugs. It's kind of interesting, you know, that the military and the police and these bureaucrats, they live in a germ-free society. They live in shells of bureaucratic, boot-kissing. You know, nobody had ever talked to Peter Bensinger, head of the DEA. You know, he had 12,000 agents and 172 stations in 79 countries. And no one had ever, kind of challenged the insanity of his program. So when I would debate him, he'd say, Hey, Timothy, sorry, but you can't say that. I'd say, why? He'd say, well, that's against the law. I said, well, not against the law to say that. They call it debate, remember? So, but this innocence of the bureaucrat was played to my advantage at the beginning because, he would say things like in front of 1,000 college students on a Friday night, get it? He would say, boys and girls, marijuana is the killer weed. It is an assassin of youth. It wasn't before, but now the marijuana you're smoking is 10 times stronger. And everybody does what? I mean, he couldn't believe it. So it was. Thank you. Cocaine really works. Toot that, and in seconds, your heart beats faster, and you start to sweat and perspire, and your body feels warm, and you have this incredible ecstasy. And that's when your heart's going. That's physiological. You get stand there. And I said, well, Peter, have you ever had an orgasm? Maybe that's against the law. Anyway, and it was amazing listening to the head of the DEA talk about the drug situation. He would, mainly marijuana and cocaine. He's not worried about heroin for some reason. He's not worried about the real killers, pills and all that. He talked about killer weed and about kill, lethal cocaine. Hey, wait a minute. Let's have some ballpark statistics here. Okay. Let's get the scoreboard out there, okay? They say there are 500 people a year that die from cocaine. Well, that's fucked. I mean, that's terrible. That's stupid. It's ignorant. There's no reason for those 500 people to die. bad education, you know. Oh, yeah, granted, there's always going to be, in a country of 200 million people, there are going to be 100 people that overdose on ketchup, so, but we can cut that rate down to 100 if you just had warnings on the package, you know. Like, the first thing, if you're going to educate people about drugs and cocaine, is you should say there's a total difference between smoking base and crack or shooting cocaine. That's the flash. And sure, that's like drinking a water glass full of tequila. Boom! No question. You get that hit and you reverberate. And your heart starts to do flips. And, yeah, right. You're feeling good. But in about a minute, it's all over and then you want more. It's like another water glass. You know, another chug-a-lug a whole fifth of tequila. Naturally, that's stupid. That's dumb. That's on the other hand, you know, tuning cocaine is an entirely different thing. You toot a little cocaine, then for about 3 hours you have some energy and you're feeling euphoric, and of course you're a loud mouth, talkative, obnoxious, arrogant asshole, but but you're alive the next morning. And you're no more obnoxious than the average drunk or a born-again Christian, so we got to live with it. So, you're talking about then? Yeah, that was cocaine. He said, now, if you want to talk about killing substances and killing lethal experiences that the American public is exposed to, how about handguns? You know, 10,000 people a year are wasted from handguns. See, that's against 500 with cocaine. Now, the thing about the handguns thing is that the victims, these guys with the guns aren't putting gunpowder up their nose. They're killing their wives, their girlfriends, or any stranger in the street. So, you're worried about health of America, think about that. Or how about 50,000 a year die from drunken driving? And of course, again, it's not the drunken driver usually that's get wasted. You know, you ever hear that Al Davis, Al Franken, Tom Davis routine about the drunken Tom Davis who comes in, he's going to give you a lecture on drinking, and he said, number one, you should never drink. And number two, you should never drink and drive. He says, however, there are times when you're way, way out in the country and you've just been thrown out of a party by the host. So what are you going to do? You got to drive, right? And he said, well, the rules are, number one, don't drive and puke at the same time. And number two, drive a big American car. So anyway, that's the alcohol situation. Then you get a quarter of a million people dying a year from cigarette smoking. So anyway, way down the list of public health situations, you got AIDS, you got nuclear bombs. You got polluted water. I mean, you know, cocaine and marijuana. Oh, yeah, marijuana. Oh, I forgot all about marijuana. You know, I got to confess to you up in front. You know, I'm pretty brain damaged. 27 years aloft, you tend to lose a few billion neurons, but you know. There are three real side effects of taking a lot of psychedelic drugs. One is long-term memory gain. I mean, you're overloaded. You're confused by too much. And the second is short-term memory loss. And the third is I forget. But I haven't forgotten about the deaths from marijuana. Yeah. Okay, the deaths from marijuana. Would you wire the Smithsonian Institute? Let's get the public health, get the United Nations, UNESCO. How many deaths from marijuana? Oh, here they come. Oh, here they're wrecking. Oh, yeah. Okay. In the 25,000 years of recorded history, the people have used in every climate have used marijuana as a... as a sacrament, as a religious experience, as a hedonic experience, as a Saturday night flash, as an adjunct to creativity. And for 25,000 years, there have been 12 known deaths from marijuana. We got to be scientific here, okay? There's an undisputed case of two or possibly four people that smoked a little too much marijuana and got the giggles and laughed themselves to death. And then there's a case of two or possibly four people that they had bad hearts and they had too much marijuana and they got the munchies and they ate themselves to death. in a case of either two or three or possibly four honeymoon couples that got a little marijuana, got carried away and fucked themselves to death. A lot of fun with that. By the way, I'm talking about drugs. I must make it very clear that, see, there's only one place where I agree with the Reagan White House. It's a fruit loopy, nitwit, ring-ding, brain-damaged group of people in that White House. They can't even remember. But there's one place where I agree with Nancy Reagan. You gotta tell your kids to say no. I got a 13-year-old son, and I got two teenagers, 14, 15, you know, and my wife and I do not want our kids, taking drugs. And God knows they're much more prevalent today than they were in the 60s when, or 70s, you know. Everything is so young right now. 14, they're watching X-rated films that I never saw until I was 40 years old, you know. So there is a definite problem here, and the kids are so depressed by nuclear war and all that stuff, and there's no hope in the country anymore. So, you know, a lot of reasons why any parent is concerned, or anyone's concerned about kids taking drugs. Well, on the other hand, you know, the Reagan White House is such a pit bull nasty. You know, we tell our kids, say no, thank you. You know. Yeah. You know, to Nancy Reagan, the world, or America's filled with good-looking, slick, intelligent, faggot, Nicaraguan-loving dope dealers that are pressing all sorts of magnificent drugs on their kids, you know. Would it were so, huh? So, definitely, you see, when it comes, of course, when it comes to your kids, we don't want our kid drinking booze. We got an open bar there. Anytime he wants, we could. But we talk to him about it. You know, we don't want him to, for good reasons. We got the keys to the car and the kitchen shelf there. We don't want him taking the keys to the car. If I had a gun, you know, so forth. So, it's rather disturbing to me that of all the mothers or grandmothers in the world that have no right to be talking to young people about drugs, it's Nancy Reagan. You know, her two children, I know both of her two children, and, you know, Patty Davis and Ron Jr., they admittedly took a lot of drugs successfully. And she was never very around very much, and she never obviously did the thing that any parent has to do or any friend has to do, and that is to sit down and eyeball and be honest and share it as a, you know, problem, and put all the support of the family and siblings and friends and church and school, or God knows that you can't call in the National Guard. That's the one thing you can't do, Nancy, and of course that's what she wants to do. So anyway, that's the say no thing. My position on drugs is, it seems very commonsensical, it's pro-choice for an adult. If you're an adult in America, you know, this is not communist China, if you're an adult American, you can decide whether you can access your own brain or who or what you put in your body. That's such common sense. And there's no way a government can stop it. That seems obvious. And, of course, it's the same crew that are going after women, you know, want to control what women do with their reproductive structures and want to poke their noses up ladies' fallopian tubes, are the same guys that are bringing us them. Yeah, so pro-choice is the American way there. I must... Now I gotta really be tough here. I'm very much against addicts and drug fuck-ups. And I think we all have been through it with friends, and you know, it's been hard on all of us going through the last 10, 15, 20 years to see dear friends just screw up with alcohol or with drugs. Of course, You can always know who these people are, the ones that are going to self-destruct. You knew them in kindergarten. You knew them in high school. You know them all. You know who they are. They're hell-bent on having a flame-out. They can use booze. They can use sex. They can use gambling. And, of course, if you're going to have a flame-out, drugs is a really good way to go right now. So I do feel that we have to intervene with every emotional and psychological and spiritual and every energy we can muster to just intervene and keep addicts, you know, get them... But, you know, the position there is that they're like diabetics, you know, because they can't handle booze, and the reason they should ban white sugar, if you follow my logic. So, I'm It's an interesting thing that puzzles me, kind of irritates me, that when the press and the government want to have drug experts dragged on the scene to tell us all about drugs, it's the fuck-ups. It's the addicts that are always on television telling you about their 30 years of lying in the gutter. So you had some guy who was married 30 times and his marriage never lasted more than one night, and he writes a book on marriage, right? Or it's like the Pope talking about sexual conduct. You know, it's pretty weird. it's the problem of television. Andy Warhol predicted it. You know, it's everyone now knows how to be a spokesperson. So they stick a microphone in front of you, and you speak not for yourself, but you speak for everybody. The kid will say, "Well, kids today don't like parents who." Well, I mean, what do you mean, kids? I mean, you don't. It's that predatory pronoun. They say you or we instead of I. David Crosby on the cover of People magazine. I've known David for 27 years. We all know David. Geez, he's not an expert on drugs. I'll tell you that. No one's perfect, David, but and he's on the cover of People magazine. He said, "You have only four choices. You will end up in jail. You will end up dead, or you will end up in a mental hospital, or you will." Kick like I did. Yeah, though. That reminds me, by the way, of a wonderful series of debates I had with another old opponent of mine, G. Gordon Liddy. Gordon Liddy is a very interesting person. One thing that you may not know about Gordon Liddy is he's a comedian. He's like Buster Keaton. He's a stand-up. He stands up there and says the most incredible things. And if you get serious about it, he's maybe frighten you, but he's really a comic actor. You ever see him in Miami Vice? I'll give you an example. Liddy is, he's a very powerful, debater because he, every time he comes on, he gets starting his thing. He fumbles with a microphone, and then he says, "I always have trouble with microphones." See, immediately. And then I remember I was debating him, and I was talking about this thing about. Gordon Liddy has never had an unauthorized thought in his life. And he's like, Ollie Pitbull North, if his master tells him to stand in the corner on his head, he will do it, as ordered. And he has never indulged in drugs. Well, Wes, there was one time when I was commanded by my military surgeon to take an anesthetic painkiller while I was in a military hospital. The pain left. I could feel the pleasure, and I requested my surgeon officer, "Please, sir, hold back the drugs. I'd rather have the pain than the pleasure." I was talking about Liddy's an easy debater too on drugs. He didn't know anything about it, but I was talking about these people that set themselves up as experts. Like I was going on about Dennis Hopper, who's been a long-term friend of mine. Dennis, how many of you seen Blue Velvet? Remember that? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Anyway. Dennis, was one of the worst drug abusers in history. I mean, the Guinness Book of Records, he's right up there. I mean, he didn't screw around either. Have you ever, now, because all AA people, all people that kick, they, since they can't do it, they like to talk about it. "Man, I was the worst, man." He said, "Oh, man, a quart of tequila a day, man." He said, "Hey, man, give me that fountain pen. See that fountain pen? Two lines like that every 10 minutes, man. That's bad." And at midnight, man, we'd all take acid, man, and hold hands, and we'd feel love, man. But at 2 o'clock in the morning, man, we were at our dealer's house with a gun in our hands. I said, "Hey, Dennis, watch those pronouns, man. Don't say we, say I." Like, "Dennis, I was never at my dealer's house at 2 o'clock. And I never had a gun in my hand." Now, if you want to talk about guns, talk to my friend over here, G. Gordon Liddy. Gordon Liddy walks up and said, "Once again, my esteemed but brain-fried opponent has erred both in logic and fact. I do not own a gun." No, shit. Gordon Liddy, that's like the Pope doesn't have a rosary. I mean, Gordon Liddy, that again. As a 7-time felon, federal law. An ex-convict, I'm forbidden by law to own a gun.
Oh, yeah.
Mrs. Liddy, however... At last count, Mrs. Liddy had 37 guns, machine guns, firearms, and I go down the list of the whole 37. And if Mrs. Liddy chooses at night to put three or four of these guns on my side of the bed, and some pinko liberal faggot Nicaraguan lover comes through the window and I blow him out the way he comes, well, that's a hard guy to debate with. I mean, really. Yeah. Okay, now, remember I told you about the roaring 20th century and the cybernetic 21st century? I'd like to tell you a little bit about how I see the roaring 20th century. You see, you got to realize I got an advantage on you here. I'm 67 years old, see? That means I've been around for 7 decades. And I tell you... they've been... I don't think any question, we're talking about the 7 most exciting decades in human history. Boom, 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 fat, one wave after another, and I've been trying to surf them, and I've been involved in, so I don't think in decades, people talk about the 60s and said, don't talk, man. Take the long view, centuries, there's a certain logic to the 20th century if you've been around it long enough. See, what happened in the 20th century started, naturally, around 1900. I wish any Apple computer people here, they can check my mathematics. But around the year 1900, there were 3 cybernetic, psychedelic, far-out philosopher physicists who presented a new version of reality, which happens to be the correct view of reality. You had Newtonian physics, where there was this solid General Motors world of force and momentum and energy and work and action and reaction, conservation, all that. Sorry, Newton. I mean, Newton's great. But, Isaac, you got to face the fact that Einstein said at first, everything is relative. See? That means that there's no absolute space and time, and that I'm moving at a certain rate and in a certain direction. You are, too, so that you and I can have very different perspectives, but it all depends on your viewpoint. Oh, that's heavy duty. Because there goes the solid world of the Bible and of all the fundamentalist religions. It's gone if you let Einstein running around loose. And imagine, for example, at the turn of the century, a typical American. Do you remember that painting by Grant Wood, American Gothic, where you have that guy with a pitchfork and his wife there? Or we'll call them Mr. and Mrs. Wood, Farmer Wood. And they can't handle his eye. What's this Jewish guy talking about? Everything's relative. We know it's not him. Well, he's making a lot of... that's fair. Then, though, comes Max Planck. He says, the reality from galaxies, stars, down to atoms and quarks is all made up, not of solid things, it's all temporary. Temporary clusters of clouds of probability off on, quanta, that means bits at the whole. Every time you put yourself, you're going to fall through a screen of quantum information energy that's just bubbling around all the time. And I know that sounds like a bad acid trip. But that happens to be the way the universe is wired at the moment. Now, can Farmer Wood handle that? He's getting a headache. Although it is true that they're bending light waves from stars around Mercury and they're getting the atomic bomb going, so these guys are, there's no question of it. Pretty soon we realize that they're not screwing around. And then Werner Heisenberg comes along with a real capper. He says, everybody's reality is subjective, that your reality is determined by your sense organs, which are limited, of course, and by the instruments you use to magnify or extend the sense organs, like microscopes, telescopes, and so forth, and by the maps or the models that you use. So you have to face the fact, Mr. and Miss America, you're making your own reality. That can't be handled. Get them back to Germany, right. And the problem was, too, that, you see, these physicists, they couldn't communicate. Why? Because they had to use a real Paleolithic caveman device, chalk on blackboard, so nobody could really understand what these guys were talking about. Okay, here's the situation. We know there's a new reality called quantum reality. It works. There's no question that that's how the universe and that's how atoms and that's how it's put together. But how are we going to persuade, convince for us, ourselves, and Farmer Brown and Mrs. Brown, how can we exist in this world, which seems so cold and hallucinatory and bizarre and weird and German and Jewish? Well, at those moments of human history, where it's time for our species to confront a new reality, whether it's going from 4 foot to 2 foot, or whether it's to make love face to face rather than, you know, whatever, there's a certain breed of human beings in every gene pool that come along at that time and make us feel comfortable. They explain, they personalize, they popularize what's really happening. Now, you know who these people are. They are the artists, the musicians, the playwrights, the poets, the mythmakers, the wizards, the jugglers, the storytellers, crazed scientists, the mischievous physicists. You know who they are. At every epoch in human history, these people come along. And Homer, blind Homer, telling us about the, you know, go through the wine, dark sea of Mediterranean, go out beyond the pillars of Hercules. Oh, yeah, right, Homer. Let's get on our boats and go out there. Yeah. So, okay, it has been the obligation of all art and all poetry and all communication in the 20th century to package, popularize, commercialize, market quantum physics. And I start, of course, with the painters. All modern painting, when you come to think of it, is exactly quantum relativistic and indeterministic. Expressionism. You write your own thing. Change the Newtonian reproductive representational picture. Impressionism, sheets of color. Pointillism, that's pixels, you know, Seurat. These are just painting the way the eye, the retina, and the computer graphic screen, sees things. Dada, surrealism. Salvador Dali, you know, straight Einsteinian physics. He has that, you know, that thing about the persistence of memory, the melting watches, remember that? That's right out of Einstein. So, well, Farmer Brown saying, well, Mother, these guys are making a lot of money, so there must be something in that. Then, of course, the writers, all the writers, 20th century, it's stream of consciousness, subjective, gonzo journalism, call it what you want. It's all, you know, writing, you're not chiseling on marble, you're giving your own point of view. Of course, the real popularization and personalization of quantum psychology occurred about the year 1920 when a group of really genius auditory engineers and acoustic scientists came along of Afro-American descent. I'm talking, of course, about jazz music, which is perfectly, classically quantum physics. See, before jazz, music is symphonic orchestras, you know, and there'd be a director, get it? And there'd be 15 violins, and they'd all be reading the same notes and playing the same way, and a soloist would read the line, sing line. It's real factory, industrial assembly line stuff. And then Sousa marching band. Here comes jazz. Improvisation. Don't talk to me, Heisenberg. There's Heisenberg on the clarinet. He's showing us how to make your own music, and everybody's syncopating, and you've never heard it played the same way before. And we can do it together. It's not that I'm a crazed solo person going on in my psychedelic canoe up there. You're listening, and you're going along with it, and then you take your improv, and we merge them together. I mean, that's quantum physics put right out there for our ears to hear it. Hey, and then, of course, radio came along. None of us can realize what radio did when Farmer Brown and Mrs. Brown got that little appliance and they started dialing and tuning realities, invisible realities, coming through the sky like wizardry. And they loved it. You know, here's Farmer Brown, and he's digging along here, and he's listening. He's eavesdropping, say, Hitler at Nuremberg, stirring up World War II. And Mrs. Brown, Mrs. Wood, she's crying because she's listening at the moment it's happening. It's like hearing Shakespeare, history being made. She's listening to the King of England giving up his throne for the woman he loved. Boo-hoo. See, for the first time in history, millions of people could tune in on the same things going on at the same time. FDR declaring World War II and so forth. Also, for example, there was a radio program in the 20s and 30s called Amos and Andy. You ever hear that? Amos and Andy? My God. Everybody would stop on Friday night for a half hour. The theaters would close, and everyone would get around the radio, and these two black guys and the Fresh Air Taxi Company and the fellow Osgood Augustus and all that. What it meant was they were all listening to the same thing at the same time. Never in human history had more than 100 or maybe 1,000 or a few thousand people attended to the same signal. And I had millions of them doing it. So that meant that what you're doing here is you're creating a new species of people that are harnessed by electromagnetic, quantum, physical stuff that old Eisenberg and... Yeah. Would have believed that farmer Grant Wood and his wife, who are down-to-earth, practical farm folk, would accept as reality shimmering, shivering, jittering little figures projected on a screen called movies. Well, gotta tell you, not only did they accept it, Farmer Grant would love it. See, for the first time, think about it. Living in his Kansas or Iowa farm, he'd never been in the room with a real glamorous, good-looking, well-dressed woman. And here's Clara Bow with her lips big as this, and she's licking her lips and looking right at who know you. Yeah, Farmer Brown's flipped out of his mind. And here's Mrs. Wood. She's looking at Rudolph Valentino and putting the eye on her. I mean, boy, turns out that human beings love quantum, cybernetic, speed of light information. You know, don't talk to me about chiseling on a marble thing, or don't talk to me about books, but human beings, the human brain, turns out, is a quantum Einsteinian Heisenberg instrument. It's been designed over 4.5 billion years with 100 billion neurons. Each one has the computing capacities of a big, big Macintosh. And we got 100 billion of them there. And they're just waiting to have this equipment turned on and booted up and activated. And that's what the quantum physical roaring 20th century is all about. You got World War II, and then you got... then, of course, you got television. Wow. Television. Who would believe in your own home, you got the little appliance, this quantum physical Max Planck appliance, and you just dial, and then suddenly there you got optics and color and so forth. People took to that. The average American family, 7 hours a day watching the boob tube. You know, that's scary. All of us have really pondered and wondered and worried about, hey, is DNA code going to finally leave us in the lurch? Are we going to become a race of vidiots with our amoeboid tentacles, you know, glued to the junk food coming out of ABC? I mean, is that 4.5 billion years going to lead to that? You remember 1984 by George Orwell? His worst nightmare was that Big Brother would have a screen in which he could watch you in your living room or your bathroom or your bedroom. You could always kind of get around the corner. But what Orwell never dreamed of was that in America and throughout most of the world today, people voluntarily line up in front of the boob tube and become vegetables. Scary, isn't it? Well, that was a scary situation. But it always happens in the history of evolution of life on this planet. You know, the life's been around for, you know, trillions of galaxies and trillions of go-rounds. So the life planning situation is not a novice here. When it's time for something to happen, it happens. And the thing that it really turned the 20th century around and saved us from becoming a nation of boob tubes happened. This gave birth to it, not in a manger in Bethlehem, but in a garage in Silicon Valley, where St. Stephen the First and St. Stephen the Second brought forth the ultimate home quantum cybernetic appliance, the personal computer. And they called it Apple. I love that. I talked once to Steve Jobs, and another time I talked to Steve Wozniak, and I said, when you call it the Apple, were you thinking about, you know, that scenario in the Bible about, you know, where the heavy-duty... Jehovah says to Adam and Eve, you know, y'all can do anything you want in paradise here, but there's only two rules and regulations. See that fruit of that tree? That's a controlled substance. Y'all are not supposed to have an apple from that tree, because that's the tree of knowledge. Get it? As soon as God got in his squad car, you know, it was Eve who went over to the apple and, like the logo of a great company, took that bite out. And anyway, that was 1976 when the apple came on just exactly when we needed it. It's almost the timing is almost precise when you think about it. Of course, the psychedelic drug movement of the 60s and 70s helped, because you can't take a species which has 100 billion neurons packing around in the skull, but who are imprinted and socially conditioned to package knowledge in the form of marble tablets that God put down, what was it, 15 commandments and lost 5 or whatever, you know, or the printed book, you know, they used to all that, and they used to talking and thinking in lettered words, and they got all this equipment up there. I mean, how are you going to get them to boot up the circuits of their brain and get them used to dealing with bytes and bits and kilowatts of all sorts of information? How are you going to get them ready for the computer, you know? How you get them? You don't have the IBM; they just become robots. How are you going to get people to really harness up their nervous system to the computer? Well, obviously, there are a lot of receptor sites in the human brain, and every neuron has got a little lock there that can be opened by a certain chemical key. And what you saw in the I think the late 60s and the 70s was an inevitable kind of historic thing that people have got to get used to the fact that the universe, according to quantum physics, is psychedelic, and it's moving and changing, and it's all multi-level, and all, talk about altered states, Einstein, you know, yeah, so it was interesting too that when we first started studying psychedelic drugs, I'm not talking about the body drugs, the euphorins and the pep pills, I'm talking about psychedelic drugs which expand consciousness, you know, and overload it and so forth and confuse it and all that. When we were first doing our research at Harvard, you know, we had no language to discuss it. We went through the textbooks of Hinduism and Buddhism, and everybody did. They were all running around with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and any, you know, half-baked yogi and occultist came along with some new... We sat down and listened to it. Gurdjieff, Crowley, you name it. We wanted to find out, well, hey, what's going on here? Because Western psychology has no words for this stuff. And eventually, we finally caught on. We started working with art engineers that work with light. And remember, we would have an anatomical movies of cells going around. Then we'd play some rock and roll, and then we'd have some slide projections of your mother on top of it. They're trying to get some feeling for the multiplicity and the complexity and the, I'm sure they're good computer terms for the enhanced high-resolution quality of the human brain stuff. But so this whole new art form of special effects and Lucasfilm and Kubrick and so forth, you know, it's all part of the same roaring 20th century getting us ready to deal with reality, what it really is, which is clusters of on bits. So... How long have I been talking, huh? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. You want a little more? Should I go on? Yeah, all right. Now, one thing that you know and I know, that there's no one today, if I'm wrong, please correct me, but can you tell me one politician, one statesman, one columnist, one writer who can give you a clear blueprint of what to do for the next 15 years? Huh? Oh, Benjamin Franklin, bring down lightning. I can go for that. You know, they got you got the four-letter words of the Republicans, Dole, Bush, Kemp, and Bork. And you got the seven dwarfs of the Democrats, and... those guys just don't understand. It's a whole new ball game, and the first time anyone comes around and tells things kind of in a, you know, really what's going to happen, people are ready to listen. I'll tell you, there's a hunger. There's an absolute void. People are desperate for some scientific, logical, common sense blueprints of what we can do and what's going to happen. And I'm looking around, and I've run into one set of interesting speculations where, naturally, in science fiction... But not science fiction of the future. See, you think about it, the science fiction that we used to read in the 60s and 70s, that was really pretty conservative. You had the Princes of Dune and, you know, and Princess Leia. Give me a break, you know, Lucas. And it was a kind of a feudal situation. The Empire strikes what? The Empire? What are you talking about, man? And Heinlein, he was an old, they were all kind of engineer types. And, yeah, there's a lot of hardware. And beam me up, Scotty. But Captain Kirk is a government employee to me. I mean, another Marine out there, you know. Point I'm making is that there was no sociology, no economics, no culture. You know, they were still going around playing World War II games. But there's a new genre of fiction. It's called cyberpunk. How many of you know about that? it's an inevitable movement. See, the things, when you think about it, it was time for a new generation of young people to write science fiction. They'd been up through the 60s and the 70s and listened to rock and roll. They weren't going to go for Captain Kirk, and they weren't going to go for Obi-Wan Kenobi's. So the cyberpunk writers, Norman Spinrad is one, there are a lot of them, Bruce Sterling, but the man that really has kind of caught all of our attention is a man named William Gibson in Vancouver, who wrote a book called Neuromancer, and it's about science fiction, a book about the world could be in 20 years. It's a real down, gritty, street wisdom, and the hero of the book is like a punk hustling kid who's a computer hacker and cowboy, and he can go into cyberspace, and he's rustling AI stuff, and he's got a drug habit here he's fooling around with, and he's down in the streets of Tokyo hustling. I've read three of Gibson's books about 10 times each. He wrote Neuromancer, Count Zero, and a collected book called Burning Chrome, and a certain philosophy is there if you can. Because Gibson would laugh, "Hey, man, I'm just writing, amusing stuff for you to read." He would decline and deny the role of prophet, but he really is laying down a theology and an economics. And one thing I've learned from Gibson's stuff is, the world in Gibson's books 20 years from now, you don't hear much about America, and they're vaguely Russian either, because vaguly Russia and America, they became second-class countries, and they spent all their money in arms, and they started, so that finally, the world is really run by Germany and Japan and Switzerland, who kind of stepped in at one point, apparently, and said to Russia and America, "Hey, we can't allow this. You simply can't go around building up arms and blowing things up. You can't blow up America because we own it." Nuclear war is bad for consumer business. See? So, and funny thing, I'm naming you former Axis countries. Kind of interesting. The worst thing that can happen to a country is to win a war. You know that. World War II, boy. Yeah, tell me about it, Ollie and Poindexter. Tell me about it. Yeah, we won World War II. Who's we? Russia and America. It's kind of funny, isn't it? And poor England had the poor luck to be dragged along and be a victor. Because the victors, number one, their military leaders were not discredited. Eisenhower and Haig, right? And all those Russian generals with acres of medals. Anytime you see a grown man dressed up in a uniform with ribbons, you know you got a psychotic case on your hands here. And it doesn't help that the turkeys are armed to the teeth with a pit bull mentality. Yeah. Well, that's the problem with Russia and America, that they're simply spending all their energies in war and military and CIA and the KGB. Meanwhile, the poor losers. Okay, Germany, Japan, and Italy, their military leaders were discredited. Hitler is not a joke. He's an absolute abhorrent. The name Hitler, you're never going to get on a uniform, with that. Or dreams of tomorrow, Dabools, get out of here, Adolf. See, Germany went right to work making consumer goods. We didn't allow them to have guns. That's a good one. We bombed all their factories. They start new factories. Same thing happened in Japan. We wouldn't let them have any military. We totally discredited that whole Tojo dreams of Nipponese empire. No, sir, we're not worried about that. We're going to conquer the world with consumer goods. You Americans and Russians have forgotten how to, because if you've forgotten, the individual human being doesn't care about big nuclear guns and tanks. The individual human being wants things to enhance his intelligence and make him feel good, or make her a little smarter, or make life a little more comfortable, or give a little class or fashion or a sense of consumer gourmet. I'm in control of my life, and I'm not a victim of the Soviet or the American factory. I'm trying to say, you get the picture. Now, in this world of the future that Gibson's vaguely talking about, it's like a vague blueprint. You have to fit in your own picture. It's really quite liberal in the sense that the Italians too, Mussolini. Give me a break. The Italians are notorious bad soldiers. Sometimes. They're credible soldiers in an individual thing, but they're not good at lining up for some cause. And I don't blame them. It's a great thing. What? Well, go for that. That's an old motto. I've heard that before. So, and the Italians are doing fine, they can't run a country. They have a government. The government's changing all the time. Good. That means the bureaucrats are changing all the time. But somehow Italy's working without the bureaucrats. It's amazing. So finally we catch on. It's the governments that cause all the fuck-ups. If you get the military and the government out, And the old, it's so corny. It's the psychedelic, cybernetic, hedonic law of supply and demand. People want certain things. It's kind of healthy for them to have, you know. So that, anyway, that, and it's very liberal because, see, this, the big companies, the international, multinational combines, that are, they don't run things. They're just kind of keeping everything moving. They don't care what drugs you take or how you fuck or what kind of magazines, as long as you're a good consumer. The main thing I'm saying is, of course, the old motto of the 1776 and 1966 of think for yourself and question authority, TFYQA. But it doesn't do any good to think for yourself if you don't know how to think. And if you're using marble tablets to think, or if you're using the alphabet of 26 meaningless letters to think, there's a French school of philosophy called semiotics, and they come out with some interesting... By the way, do you know that the French, and many of you in the audience come from Silicon Valley, but the French have a computerized telephone system called Minitel? See, apparently, interesting, we learned from the French. The French didn't have a telephone system for a long time. De Gaulle would not allow it. You know why? For many reasons. Number one, the French man felt that if he had a telephone at home and he went off to work or went to visit his mistress, his wife would use the phone to you know what. So as a good man, he could go out of the house. He didn't want his wife to have a telephone. Secondly, when a bell rings, you have a servant ring. So the idea that the bell would ring and you'd pick it up would be in your servant, see? So that also, you couldn't control information if you had a telephone. But same thing in Moscow. Apparently, there's no telephone book, you know, in Moscow, a city of 10 million people. But anyway, now, since Gestang, they now have a Minitel system where most every home has a telephone, which is computerized in a little screen. And people are going crazy doing networking, you know, these computer networks, and being very French. About 40% of all of the telephone bills and all the computer time that's racked up is in, they call it message rows, I mean, sex messages. So the French are a little ahead of us in this computer thing. And in the philosophy, too. The French semiotic people like Marcel Foucault, have taught me something very interesting. They say, never mind about politics or economics or religion, it's language that controls society and controls the individual. And who controls the language controls everything. Parents control the language, therefore they control the kids. The literate, educated control the illiterate and the uneducated. The rich have the language, they can control the poor. Those that have access to television, radio, printing presses, if you control the language and the technology of the language, you control the minds. It makes a lot of sense. That's the downside. The good side is that if you can learn how to use the knowledge technology, the language technology, then you are armed with defenses that it's the ultimate revolutionary tool, a new language. Rock and roll was a new language. Amplified sound was a new language. And of course, we owe it to Jobs and Wozniak and the Silicon Valley people. The personal computer allows you to do exactly what these French philosophers say we got to do, control your own screen. Now, here, everyone's sitting there watching 7 hours a day screens and going off to movies, MGM, ABC. Oh, come on. They're controlling our minds. The solution is not to turn it off, because you've given them the Einsteinian quantum physical power. We've got to learn how to change the screens. And that's where personal computers come, and that's where new software comes. And unless you can control what's on the screens in your own TV, in your own home, you know, okay, then you're going to have, see, within 2 or 3 or 4 years, compact discs, interactive compact discs, where you can store dozens of films or videotapes, or Dan Rather, the news, throw in your X-rated movie, home movie you made last night. You're going to have all this digitized sound in your CD library, where you can make your own news. You can make your own 10 best items of the week. You are the director, the producer, the editor of your own screens. And that's just as obvious and logical to me as when Gutenberg produced a book, then we, the human individuals, could could write, which was illegal under feudalism, the same thing is happening. So the real message that I get from the 20th century is learn how to be cyber hip, cybernetic. Learn how to deal with electrons. And of course, the keyboard's finished. We owe it to the Macintosh and those guys at Xerox PARC. You don't get rid of that Phoenician alphabet keyboard using gloves and mice and joysticks and so forth. Literacy, my friends, is the oppressive chains of the educated middle class. Yeah. Literacy. You got to get away from those books and controlled by the printing press and the highfalutin intellectual. I've written enough books to destroy several forests of trees in Canada. I plead guilty, but yet. And by the way, when you learn how to move electrons around on screens and move and store compact disk stuff, you can still read. You can still curl up on the beach and read to your heart's desire. You're not giving anything up. You're adding a tremendous dimension to your mind and your skill. Okay, now, boys and girls, is that a locker room pep talk or what? Huh? Okay. How many of you want to hear about Hunter Thompson? Yeah.
He's a local boy. He does a column on Mondays.
Well, I love Hunter Thompson. You know, I've never met Hunter. I've never met Hunter Thompson all these years, but the mad programmers of this... what? Anyway, I was in a deal in Seattle, Washington about 2 months ago in which they had... I know who thought this up. It was like a debate or a tribate between Abbie Hoffman, Hunter Thompson, and myself. Now, I've read all of his books many times. I love his books. I follow his exploits as Ambassador Duke in Doonesbury. He called me a couple of times, although we never met. I'd get phone calls late at night by 3 a.m. from someone who said it was Hunter Thompson wanting dangerous drugs. And I had to tell him to fuck off. But I don't think that could have been Hunter. No. Yeah. Anyway, I met him in Seattle. I'll never forget. He came down the from the plane, and man, he had a paper bag in one hand. He had that cigarette with a holder, and he had that baseball hat. And he said, "Let's get drunk, Timmy," and so forth. And then Abby came off the plane with a bandana like a rustler. I look at these two guys, and for the first time in my life, I felt like the squarest guy in the house. I'm out of my league. We're talking major troublemakers here, and. Anyway, there was a press conference. The press conference, of course, I showed up, and then Abby showed up. Finally, Hunter showed up, and he started drinking whiskey. And then the press took it very seriously. He said, "Well, Mr. Thompson, what do you think of the college students today? Generation of swine." "Well, Mr. Thompson, what do you think of the college students 20 years ago? Generation of swine." When it came time for the lectures, 8 o'clock, boy, they love, you know, Hunter Thompson is an extremely popular person in this country among young people. He's a fabulous, he's like Robert Anton Wilson, fabulous. You don't really realize how popular and wonderful he is. Anyway, it's an enormous crowd, and about time to go, 10 of 8, I said, "Hey, let's go." And I went down to Hunter's room, and Hunter's on the phone talking to someone named Tony, telling Tony to get his ass over there, something about an 8-ball, so I couldn't follow that. And then it turned out that Hunter had suckered Abbie Hoffman into a $100 bet on the Houston Sonics or the Rockets basketball game, and shit, it's only in the second quarter. They're really, these guys are not going to show up at that lecture, so, but I think, good. Because the only chance I'm going to have to talk is if I get there first. So I went to the studio, get me over there. Beautiful, beautiful backstage thing, and I got out there and said, "Well, I'm like the warm-up for the Joan Rivers show, and I'll tell you what I have in my mind." And after about 20 minutes, they come in, and Abby gives this incredible talk. Oh, yeah. Boy, stem winding and kicking ass at the CIA and all that. And then Hunter got up there, and Hunter kind of mumbling, and he said to me, "Hey, Tim, has Tony come?" I said, "What? Tony, you know, Tony." "Well, I don't know." He said, "Well, go outside and see if Tony's in the back room." So I walked up there in the back room, and well, Tony had definitely come because the air was all blue with some resinous smoke. And I said, "Is there a gentleman named Tony here?" The guy said, "Come here." He took me down this hallway, and he pressed a small envelope in my hand, and he pushed me into a men's room. Well, you know, I'm basically a scientist. And furthermore, as an older person, I thought it was my duty to protect young fellows like Hunter Thompson from any dangerous substance. So I did make a kind of a scientific test of it, and came bounding back into the room, and then Hunter left, and then Hunter came back, and then that was the end of the debate. It was just boom. I mean, Hunter is really one of those people that is greater in person than his reputation, which is great. So, yeah. There's no excuse for a human being in the 21st century to accept any helplessness or impotence or passivity, blaming it on genes or whatever. It's up to you. You've got to take pilot control of your own life. Now, if that isn't a fucking pep talk, locker room, spellbinding, rabbi, priest talk, go for it. I'll see you in 20 years. Thank you and good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, the 21st century man, Timothy Leary.
You're listening to The Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
Yeah, I can still remember the first time I heard Sgt. Pepper. It was on vinyl and at a going-away party 3 days before my friends and I left for a tour of duty in Vietnam. But that's a story for another day. And no doubt you have a story about that album yourself. Although a good many of our fellow saloners weren't even born yet when Sgt. Pepper hit the streets. So I guess you'll just have to take the word of us dusty old farts that that album probably did as much to change the world of music as Elvis did. But enough looking back, our job is to keep moving forward, so let's press on. Now if you've been listening to the most excellent podcast of The Dope Fiend, which you can find at dopefiend.co.uk, you know that there is a raging debate going on about the current potency of cannabis. So I know that you picked up on what Dr. Leary was saying about 17 minutes or so into his talk, where he told the audience about the then-current DEA scare tactic about the increased potency of pot. I guess it doesn't occur to these knuckle-draggers in the government that if the potency is higher, we use less, just like most people don't drink whiskey in the same quantities as they do beer. But wasn't it interesting to see that about every 20 years or so, they recycle their bogus arguments about cannabis? I guess that's what frustrates me the most about this insane war on people who use plants instead of patented pharmaceuticals. It's the fact that these ignorant drug warriors think that we're as stupid as they are. But my question is, hey, what happened to all of those young people in the 80s that Dr. Leary was just talking about? Did they get sucked into the system too? Well, I think we know the sad answer to that question. So that leaves you and me to pick up the pieces and keep the show on the road. And in fact, that's what I'll be doing for the next 2 weeks or so, going on the road. So I'm afraid that you won't be hearing from me again here in the salon until the middle of next month. Unless, of course, you happen to be fortunate enough to be able to attend the Oracle Gathering that is going to take place from July 31st through August 2nd. And there I'll be conducting a little workshop from 7 to 9 on Saturday night, just before the main event begins, which is a night filled with music, dancing, and a few other surprises. And if all goes well, I'll be playing part of that workshop in a future podcast. So for the next few weeks, you shouldn't expect much activity from me on Facebook or thegrowreport.com or on my new website, which you can find at www.genesisgeneration.us. And I'm not going to be able to be checking my email at all, but since I'm already about 6 months behind in my email, that won't make a whole lot of difference, I guess. But I do want to thank our fellow saloners who have either sent or offered to send some lost McKenna recordings. I most definitely will get back to each of you as soon as I can, hopefully next month sometime. But I do intend to take you all up on your offers, and over time we should be able to hear a whole bunch of new McKenna material. Now, as much as I dislike doing this, I'm going to have to point out that there may be some confusion brewing about where I'll be making public speaking appearances in the coming months. To be exact, there are only two places where I'll be speaking, and one is the Oracle event, which you can learn more about by going to Oracle Gatherings, that's gatherings plural, oraclegatherings.com, and the other festival I'll be attending is the Symbiosis Gathering, and I'll say more about that at the end of today's podcast. But the event I will definitely not be at is one that several saloners have asked about because apparently the promoters are using the psychedelic salon's name in their ads. Now, I know that imitation is the most sincere form of flattery, but it can also breed confusion. Now, back in June of 2005, just before I posted the first podcast from the salon, I did a Google search on the phrase psychedelic salon in quotes. And on June 10th of 2005, there was not a single hit on that phrase. And so I decided to use it as my title. And just now I did the same Google search and discovered that there are now over 17,000 instances of that phrase being used on the web. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not at all upset by the widespread use of the phrase. In fact, since I'm a lawyer myself, I could easily have trademarked it. But my personal opinion is that no one should be allowed to have the exclusive use of common words, and so I didn't worry about some big company trying to edge me out and take over the name. But it never occurred to me that somebody I knew would appropriate for their own fundraising purposes, and so I was really taken aback when I started receiving emails with links to an announcement for a MAPS fundraiser that is titled Book Launch and Psychedelic Salon. Now, since my own book hasn't exactly taken off yet, it really hurt my feelings to see that Rick Doblin was using the salon to push somebody else's book to raise money for MAPS. And I know what you must be thinking. Old Lorenzo is just getting cranky and doesn't want to help MAPS, even though they never bothered to ask if it was okay to mislead some people into thinking that they would be attending a live session of the salon. And I'm sure that general grumpiness is part of it. But since Rick and I have been associated since even before he started MAPS, I thought that at least he'd give me the courtesy of a heads up, but that didn't happen. And so I now feel compelled to lay out the entire story, dirty laundry and all, for everybody to hear. There's hardly a week that goes by in which somebody doesn't send an email asking why I haven't done any promotion for MAPS since my last podcast of one of Rick's talks back in September of 2005. Well, there's a good reason for that. And although I've kept my silence here in the salon for all these years, I feel that now I must make very clear that I am no longer supporting MAPS and that I have no affiliation with them at all. In fact, my wife and I even stopped making our nominal donations to them after Rick dismissed a critic some years ago by saying he didn't need that person's support because the guy was only donating $100 a year. Well, that really turned me off, but it isn't the reason I no longer support them. My reason for no longer supporting MAPS is that they continue to fund and support a DEA informant, who, in fact, is probably more responsible for the disappearance of LSD on the street than anybody else I know. And that DEA informant, that turncoat, that government snitch, is Dr. John Halperin. I don't know about you, but there is no way I want to be associated in any way, shape, or form with a DEA informant. And by the way, this isn't just my opinion. I know for a fact that most of the top-tier speakers who were scheduled to attend another conference that MAPS is planning all backed out because Halperin was also on the program. And it was only after Rick promised that Halperin wouldn't be there in person but would only be piped into a small side room through a video link that they even agreed to speak again. And if you want to read all of the glory details of Halperin's involvement with the government, which resulted in 95% of the acid supply drying up and the main chemist being put in a prison cage for two life sentences, well, I'll post links to several lengthy articles about it that were written by John Hanna and by Eric Davis. But even after all of the grief that Halperin has brought to our community, MAPS continues to give him large sums of money that generous people have donated to them. And I simply cannot go along with that. And so for several years now, I have very quietly been avoiding the whole scene. And had they not used the salon to bait and switch people into another plea for money, I would have continued to be silent about my feelings about MAPS. I know that a lot of good people are associated with that organization, and I wish you all well. Of course, I do hope that the ultimate mission of MAPS is never realized, because I also don't think that it's right to try and get a patent on the medical delivery of LSD and MDMA and other substances, and that's what Rick hopes to get an exclusive on. To me, the desire to patent the use of our sacred medicines is as obscene as those corporations who are filing patents on our genes, or like Amazon's claim that they alone have the right to one-click buying on the web, as if some grammar school child couldn't have come up with that idea. Okay, enough ranting. As far as I'm concerned, this chapter is now closed, and so please don't try to engage me in an email or other discussion about MAPS. I'm moving on now. Case closed. Well, I guess that since I'm already on some kind of a heavy trip or something here, I should also mention something that a number of our fellow saloners who have been listening to my novel, The Genesis Generation, have had some problems with. In it, one of the characters tells about five of her friends who recently died, three of which involve the use of our sacred medicines. And the question, of course, is whether or not this is based on fact. And, sadly, yes, it is. Now, I'm not going to get into it here in the salon, at least not for now, because there's enough discussion about drug safety in my book. But what I do want to point out is that, yes, there is most definitely some physical danger involved if you don't use these medicines properly. And all it takes, of course, is a little reading at arrowwood.org and some common sense. You see, two of those deaths involved using a psychedelic in water and drowning. It seems obvious, but you'd be amazed at how many experienced psychonauts still use these substances in bathtubs, jacuzzis, and swimming pools. And if you want my opinion, anybody who mixes psychedelics with large pools of water is just plain stupid. And that little comment will probably cost me a few friends, too, but that's just the way I feel. And one of the other deaths I mentioned in the book involved mixing several different substances with alcohol, and then the woman passed out on her back and drowned in her own vomit. Not a particularly nice way to begin the next phase of one's eternal existence. So even though I extol the virtues of a psychedelic experience, I hope that you don't think it's all fun and games. This great work is serious business. But, of course, I doubt that many of us would be involved in this work if it also wasn't a lot of fun. So, hey, just be sensible and think before you swallow, because once you take the red pill, there's no turning back. But speaking of fun, in a few days, my wife and I will be heading north on our way to the Oracle Gathering, which is going to be held at Dragon's Spear Park in Washington. And if you go to Oracle Gatherings, that's gatherings plural, oraclegatherings.com, you'll find a listing of over 30 musicians and DJs who will be performing that weekend. Also, there is going to be a Communiversity featuring around, I guess, about 20 or so different workshops, not to mention the artists and performers who are also going to be participating. As you can tell from my general grumpiness today, I really need to get away and recharge my batteries with some input from what promises to be a fantastic gathering, and I'm really looking forward to seeing a lot of my friends there again. Now, if you can't make that event, there is one more festival that I'll be attending this year, and if you can make it, I think you'll find that you are in the right place at the right time. And I'm speaking about the 4th Annual Symbiosis Gathering, which will take place near, but not in, I should add, but near Yosemite National Park in California. And it's going to take place from September 17th through the 21st, and they also have a packed agenda. For starters, you'll be able to hear an incredible amount of music. In fact, you can go to their webpage and you'll find that there are over 100 musicians and DJs listed, along with links to their MySpace and Facebook pages where you can get to know them a little better before you go to the festival. Also, there's going to be quite a few workshops and lectures there as well. I'll be giving a presentation there myself sometime around 5 o'clock on Saturday, but you'll also be hearing a little from me all day long as I will be the MC for the day. And just to give you a little idea of who some of the other speakers will be, they include Daniel Pinchbeck, Starhawk, the famous physicist Frihof Capra, and Allison and Alex Gray, among many others. And you can see the full program at their main website, which is www.symbiosisgathering.com. And I'll put the links to both the Oracle and Symbiosis Gatherings along with the program notes for this podcast. So between now and the end of September, I hope to be able to meet a lot of our fellow saloners in person. And I know that if you're going to Burning Man, you must be saying, what the fuck? Why did Lorenzo cancel on us but is going to these other festivals? Well, it isn't because I don't love you, and it isn't because I don't enjoy the Burning Man Festival. But going to the Burn is a very expensive undertaking, and when I first planned on going there, I had the fantasy of my new novel becoming a bestseller overnight. Obviously, I'd been using too much of my own medicine. Now that reality has firmly taken hold, I've been forced to realize that, for a while at least, I'm only going to be able to attend festivals where I can get some of my expenses paid if I sing for my supper, so to speak. I wish things were otherwise right now, but I'm sure you'll understand, particularly since almost everybody I know is also having to tighten their belts a little right now. But if you are being forced to stay close to home this summer, well, there's one new little spot on the web where I hope you'll want to spend a little of your time, and that is my new dig-like site for the Genesis Generation. Now, this isn't meant to replace any of the forums over at thegrowreport.com. That's still the main place I go to get to know the tribe. And, of course, our comments section at the Notes from the Psychedelic Salon blog are always full of interesting thoughts. But I have another reason for starting yet another website. As you probably remember, a couple of years ago, Erock X1 set up a nice MySpace page for us. And within months, it was going strong. Then, one morning, when I went there, it was all gone. I'd essentially been disappeared by the MySpace censors. So all of the work that went into that effort was wasted. Now, today, a lot of saloners are going to Facebook and finding the people who have joined the Fans of Lorenzo page that Tom Barbalay set up for us. And gradually, more and more saloners are finding the others who live nearby through little connections like that. But I have this sinking feeling that one day the Facebook people might do the same thing to us that the MySpace goons did and just delete me. So the purpose of this new site is to give us a place that has no advertising whatsoever, not even those ubiquitous Google ads. This is a private site and no one can take it away from us. Now, if you use Dig, you already know that you can form groups of your friends, and these groups can be public or private. You can set them up for yourself, and you don't have any webmaster help required to get it going. Now, it's probably going to take a few years for this to grow into a place that you visit regularly, but I wanted to move the discussion of the wide range of topics that I covered in my novel to its own site and not clutter up the other established discussion boards. So, if you'd like to join us, all you need to do is surf over to www.genesisgeneration, that's all one word, genesisgeneration.us, and click on the Genesis Generation Salon link. From there, you may have a little learning curve if you've never used Dig, but it isn't all that complicated, and I think that in time you'll find it to be a good place to more or less keep your own list of web pages that interest you. And hopefully they'll be of interest to some other saloners, and that you can get your own private conversations going about some of the topics that we find so interesting here in the salon. Well, as you can see, I'm running out of steam because I've got a lot of packing to do, and so I'll be leaving you now for a few weeks, and if all goes according to plan, we'll be back together here in the salon again around the middle of August. Until then, I hope you're having a joyous summer. And if you're able to make it to the Oracle Gathering on the 31st, be sure to come up and introduce yourself. Don't be shy. After all, the main reason I'm going is to be there to meet as many of our fellow saloners as possible. Well, that's going to do it for now, and so I'll close today's podcast by reminding you that this and most of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are freely available for you to use in your own audio projects under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And don't forget to surf over to genesisgeneration.us and say hello. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.